Think about it a little bit because also often using what I'm not sure exactly, I wouldn't want to give a different answer on that specific issue of listening to what I'm seeing on the community guard, but I thought that if the legislation provides safeguards, that would actually also be safeguards not only in telling, not only in putting down principles, but also as to how they should be implemented. But I don't really think that it will change as much if you say by the public body, because how is the public body able to do that? I mean,
no, see, the concern in that regard is one must be careful, and this is going to become extremely difficult, because the question is, if you have a creature of statute, your powers, duties, and functions are elected directly from the legislation. Strictly speaking, I mean, the king of the direction of our state law is provided as well, but if you start providing the public body or the creature of statute with a general power to provide additional or adequate or sufficient safeguard by means of administrative means, the question is, aren't those then authorized? That's the question for me. I don't know whether one could just simply say that you must provide adequate safeguards, but you don't give any express indication of how that will be done, either by way of regulation or possibly a code or what it is.
To me, Mr. Chairman, the core of the issue here is the notion of adequate. Who is to judge what is adequate? Not, what we are doing here with this deal, we are setting up a territory framework of obligations which are going to be implemented by means of regulations, which are going to be implemented by means of supervisory action of the regulator. At the end, it boils down to specific rules. What type of firewalls you need to keep on your computer so that you can preserve the personal information in a manner that your computer is not going to be hacked in by somebody who can steal it, steal them. And how often do you need to review them? How often do you need to go and check with the people whose information you're keeping, whether they're still consenting? And all these rules of detail, none of them will be in the legislation. So the adequacy is not going to be assessed by comparing pieces of legislation. The pieces, they could have the same piece of legislation on their books and utilize a 10-year-old firewall, and that would not do it. So my humble suggestion is that this doesn't do it. We may perhaps do away with this entire notion and have everyone bound, everyone covered, except when they go to the regulator and they get an exemption from the regulator. And that will empower the regulator to monitor and supervise the terms of the extension, so that if down the road they do not upgrade their firework, the firewall, then the extension is withdrawn. And that is a matter of being adequate, being themselves in compliance with what this act is trying to achieve by older means. And that's what we're trying to capture.
What you're doing there is trying to get to the back door of the evolution of speed or something like that.
Sure, but may I possibly provide an answer to that? Dr. Robinson, possibly to consider that, because I appreciate now the old implementation concern. But we must be careful and assist remind ourselves how the exclusion is worded. The exclusion on page 12, for example, of one of our previous working documents is that the Act does not apply to the processing of personal information. So that's already extremely important. Irrespective of what standing or legislation, if you process personal information, then the Act won't apply if that processing is by or on behalf of the public body in our paragraph sheet. And then it goes on to give us a few sub-paragraphs, and then I'm being taught. So it's processing of personal information first of all, by or on behalf of a public body, and then after we've gone through the Roman subparagraph Roman 1 and 2, we only get to the point where we say to the extent that adequate safeguards have been established. So let me put it this way. If I have adequate safeguards in my legislation, there is no responsibility on me to implement those provisions if they are merely in my legislation. But if I start processing my personal information, then that adequate safeguards become extremely important. And that is why I think we do not really need to concern ourselves with whether adequate safeguards must be implemented. If you process personal information, there's no doubt in my mind that the wording of that sub-clause will require that you will have to process in line with your adequate safeguards.
It's all fine. We're not for the world establishing specific legislation for the protection of such personal information. I mean, we are in a process. We agree to things, then one goes back, looks at them. I try to look at where is the specific legislation. Specific legislation for the protection of personal information. And I couldn't find it. So look at the Financial Intelligence Center Act. Where is the specific legislation for the protection of personal information? So probably we may end up with a conclusion that this exemption does not apply because there isn't any such legislation, which I'm fine with it. If this what boils down to.
Chair, I think that is a technical point that we can address and amend accordingly, because it's a question of interpretation. If the committee is not satisfied with the word specific, it can either be omitted or we could possibly, by way of clarification, aim to work in the direction where that adequate safeguards can be provided in any legislation, even the legislation that has established you as a creature of statute. As long as it is closely situated or preferably in the same legislation that creates your powers, functions and duties, especially as far as it relates to the processing of personal information. to provide you possibly with an extremely uncomplicated example, and possibly not a very good example, but what I'm trying to say is SAS, they operate in terms of many pieces of legislation. Now, it's obvious that you will not provide your adequate safeguards in the Criminal Procedure Act, which is also applicable to SAS, but possibly the SAS Act itself. So, in my view, the issue just arrived by Dr. Andersen could possibly be addressed by merely a redraft and not even possibly a drastic one, possibly only just to omit the word specific legislation.
It doesn't have to be legislation. I mean, why can't it read that adequate safeguards are in operation or are in place to ensure the protection of such personal information?
But then who is going to
be adequate? Well, that's the whole issue. The adequacy is specific to even whether it's legislation or the moment you talk about adequate safeguards. That's the question I raised this morning. Who determines that? Well, it could be the regulator, or it could be if there's a dispute around the processing, then it would be the court. So I think that's something. But to my mind, I'm not sure. I mean, I think the problem would be the way it works at the moment is that if the legislation doesn't provide any mention of safeguards, in for example, the Police Act, then are the police no longer not excluded?
That's not the intention.
But it was an issue of does the safeguard have to be by legislation, or does it have to be that the safeguard needs to be in place?
That is certainly something that we can look at. But I would just like to, and I'm just going one step backwards, and I would just like to address something else that you raised now, and I actually wanted to mention it this morning. We must keep in consideration that this is framework legislation. And irrespective of whichever institution comes and say and promise and say you'll have adequate safeguards in our legislation or not, the implementation of this legislation cannot be delayed until each and every creature of statute that may qualify for an exclusion in terms of clause 4 have adapted or amended the legislation accordingly. I mean, that it will just delay the implementation of this whole indefinitely.
Yes, but the way you've got it worded, unless they amend their legislation to provide safeguards in their legislation, then the exclusion will not apply to them.
Yes.
And I don't think that's the intention. I mean, they may have safeguards, but that may be working fine. But can you look at the aspect? But I think the problem is that this is new, so are there any safeguards in existing legislation? I mean, when you were dealing on this much with the protection of state information, did you put any safeguards for the protection of personal information in information dealt with by the intelligence agency? But I know you did, but is it not an issue of, well, maybe it's not in the security, I mean, the intelligence legislation, I mean, not in the Protection of State Information Bill, but maybe in the other intelligence legislation. Is there any provision for the protection of personal information? Mark, have you got any?
On a general basis, the issue of information security is obviously that security itself depends on the nature of the information and how it is processed, and it's very much a moving target. So at the moment, insofar as our legislation is concerned, there used to be the minimum information security standard, which from my perspective has no legal standing at all. It was a document
that was put up. We know that. That's around certification. It's a question of information held by the intelligence services. Is there any provision in any of their laws? I know MIST has no legal standing, but that relates to classification. Is there any information, any provision, if you want to exclude the intelligence agencies from this bill when it comes to the processing of information, the safeguards that they need to follow, are the safeguards that
No, what I want to come to, Mr. Chairman, if I may, is that there's been a recognition that this drafted in 19 whatever it was, and there are draft information security standards. My understanding is that they are dependent on the protection of information bill being enacted, or protection of state information bill being enacted, and they are going to form part of the regulation at a government. Insofar as government is concerned. So if you're talking about the technical issues around the protection of information, there are, we've got in the public sector that would come into play eventually. And in the private sector, you've got the Companies Act underpinned by King 2 and King 3. And King 3 specifically says you've got to assess risk and put in the appropriate protections against that risk. The other aspect of it is that King 3 specifically also provides, as I think that our constitution allows, where there are codes of practice or standards that are appropriate, that those should be the codes of practice and standards that you will be judged by in dealing whether you've actually put in adequate or reasonable protection in those circumstances. Because there's absolutely no way that from an information security perspective that there can be legislation or even regulation in place because it moves all the time. It's changing all the time. So these standards are changing and evolving all the time as well. And that's why the term that we've used in, I think it's section 21, relating to security safeguards in the condition, is generally accepted information security practices.
On your specific question, there is a trio or a portrait of laws, things like the Intelligence Services Act, and I don't claim to know them well enough to answer you, but it is my clear impression that they do not deal with it, and it is a highly relevant question. Because people, when they get vetted at various levels for service, in the sort of thing, not only the service itself, but in a sort of committee, when they get vetted, deeply personal information is then taken. And as my impression is from people who have a background in the service, there are no protections in place, and they are in fact concerned about that. So this should apply. And you do need this, if you're going to exclude the government departments, you must have a safe side.
Yeah, as I understand, Mr. Hink, and maybe I've misunderstood him wrongly, but because things are moving all the time, if you make it conditional on safeguards in legislation, it may be unimplementable. And therefore the issue of adequate safeguards being in place may be a better wording. Because, for example, look, the other piece that applies to the prosecutors, the NPA, I'm not aware of any provisions in the NPA Act relating to the protection of personal information of the people that they deal with. Mario?
The answer that we received confirms my impression, and Dean also speaks about impression. I think we need to first leave it at the level of impression, but my clear impression is that none of those pieces of legislation deals with what it deals with. I read the list, I know the new deal that we are looking at, the other company factor. There are different aspects, there is no overlapping. This is the law. And I don't see any other law being passed in the future dealing with this, and there shouldn't be. There is no reason. So this is the law that should apply to everyone. This is the regulator that should apply to everyone. It is within the function of the regulator. You should call, looking at situation, extending, to make an assessment of adequacy, not on the basis of the legislation,
but on the basis of what the relevant entity actually does and promised to do for as long as it does do what it promised to do. So there is where we should look at the extension. But from a statutory viewpoint, this is the law of the land. Everyone is covered, except if it is extended in terms of thresholds, and that's my point, or in terms of inadequacy assessment that could be made by the regulator.
I think, can you look at a draft for that? But I think the way you've got it linked to two issues, you've got it linked to legislation, statutory, and presumably that should be in a bill, and an act could be in regulation. Is that the best way of ensuring that there are these safeguards? And then the second, and it would not be better to talk about rather than what statute says, that the safeguards that are in operation are being used instead of that. And then it's the question of who, you know, the adjudication of, which applies anyway to the draft, the adjudication of adequacy. When I raised this earlier, I think we're talking about the courts determining that in the event of a dispute around the processing of legislation. The regulator does have an overall function of looking at the implementation or the monitoring of the act. Is that a sufficient duty on the regulator to look at the safeguards in place in these bodies? Can you look at those aspects and give us feedback? Okay. Mark, I want to move on. Do you have any bit of
notes? Very shortly, Mr. Chairman, the Information Commissioner in the UK is increasingly doing those adequacy assessments. Just recently, there was that district of Hertfordshire, they lost 200,000 personal records. And the ruling against them was simply that they had not done adequate considering the nature of the body and what they had in place. And I think that that's where it has to be.
The assessment of adequacy, I think, is determined by the circumstances of the entity, so it's not an answer. What have you got and how do you protect it? So that's, I think, is an additional element we need to keep in mind, which points to an administrative function rather than a legal comparison.
The reference that I made this morning with the E directive is only really concerned with one pillar, or it used to be, and it still is, but it's going to change now. So one would almost think that critical information, such as that which we're dealing with here, should be exempted, should be a blanket exemption, because of the fact that the E directive doesn't deal with it. It should just be out of the law, but it isn't dealt with like that. And there are different options that different countries deal with that. There are a few countries, but there are really very few that actually do have that exemption. So they just say it's just being automated. The other countries, there are different options. You can, for instance, have authorization at cabinet level. Now, sometimes for certain pieces of, for certain sections of processing to be excluded, you think that it's usually combined with authorization from the Information Commissioner, or that's in France, or together with an appeal to a tribunal in the UK, for instance. In the Netherlands, they actually have separate legislation, and I think we got our idea from there. But there it says, this act does not apply to the processing of personal data, for instance, governed by or under the Municipal Database Personal Records Act, or for the purposes of implementing the Judicial Documents and Certificates of Good Behavior Act, or for the purposes of implementing the Electoral Provisions Act. So that's how they refer. They refer to a specific act. Now, this is also an example that you find quite often, and I think that's where we got. The idea is that any act in a country should actually be in harmony with the PPI. I mean, you can't have an act dealing with personal information which does not make provision for a sexual act. I'm talking about sexual act. If you have a sexual act, if it's not yet in harmony with the PPI, then you would have to bring it in harmony, because it can't be different.
Yeah.
So that is where this idea comes from. But what we asked in our first discussion paper, we asked for national intelligence and all those to harmonize their legislation, because there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 acts that deal with personal information in that area. I think some of the ones that is supposed to refer to. And you said that it's actually a mess. That they have acknowledged it, that there's a lot of work to be done there. And we asked them, well, can't you harmonize it for us? And then give us one act that we can exclude from this bill. And they said, this will not happen in 100 years, so we can't do that. So what we actually did then was actually to describe what we would have liked to do and say,
the difficulty is, you've got a exclusion conditional on adequate safeguards established in legislation, specific legislation. What it appears is that in a number of these cases, that does not exist.
Yes, but that is actually a belt and braces, because even if you took out the safeguards, there should be adequate safeguards in every piece of legislation. Otherwise, that piece of legislation is not in accordance with the PPI.
Yes, but the PPI is being passed now, and there's a whole lot of laws on the statute books, which will take time to be revised.
Yes.
I don't think this is taking it any further. I mean, you can keep it as this is, but can you look at a draft as well, an option of a broader wording of adequate safeguards are in place, which I think should make everybody happier, or in operation, or being implemented, or provided there are adequate safeguards to protect that personal information.
Yes, because I think the idea is that since we sort of knew that there weren't adequate safeguards in place, this act will actually be in place until you get your safeguards in place. So it's a sort of an encouragement to get your own legislation in place so that you can actually...
Yes, but we all know how long things work. So, I mean, that's a bit of a... You're effectively giving... And I don't know if these bodies were aware of it, you're giving a non-exclusion.
We're
going to end up doing that. We're going to end up saying, provided safeguards, operational safeguards are in place.
Okay.
And the effect of that will be that the regulator will have to, under Section 34, will have to grant an exemption once somebody is up to standard. And therefore, this is actually not really anymore an exclusion. All it will achieve is it will make these people start looking at their systems and go to the regulator, which is not maybe a bad thing.
Yeah. Chair, may I just ask, looking at the option that we've got available to bring back an amended version of this, would there be a need for some sort of parliamentary intervention, or not necessarily? If you adopt measures, let's say, for example, it's national instructions or whatever, to be issued by a statutory body, would you require, like we have with our regulations, usually at least approval by Parliament or submission to Parliament, or not necessarily?
Yeah, I mean, one would imagine the provisions would be extremely detailed. I mean, I don't know the intelligence bodies, but let's take the NPA or the Police Act, which don't have any provisions regarding the protection of personal information when it comes to the investigation and the prosecution of offences. I don't think it's necessary for Parliament to approve. I mean, it is the regulator; they're the qualified body. Okay, but can you look at that section? If you go the way that I'm suggesting, then maybe it seems to be, from what Ms. Smuts is saying, is then it wins her case and it becomes no longer necessary, because you can apply for the exemption anyway. But can you look at that aspect of the wording? Then am I correct in saying that the other SIU, well, the SIU request that they get named is then not being supported on the basis that if we, that they are covered, if we start naming them, we've got to name everybody, and then if there's somebody who gets left out, then there would be an issue around why did they get left out if there's ever a legal dispute. Okay. Just before we go on to the annexures, one other aspect, because it is on clause 4, I've just got a note from Christine regarding the media exemption, that Ms. Smuts asked Ananda to resubmit and the proposals and to say which one she prefers. I don't know if Ananda, if you remember that.
I did submit to Ms. Smuts, and the one that we...
Did you submit to Ms. Smuts?
Yes, she asked me whether I was then sent her the documents.
Oh, okay.
It was,
I received a very useful document, but I'm not sure that they contained, because the thing I was looking for was your last proposal. I'm not sure that they did contain.
Well, isn't the last proposal option 4 on page 13?
Is it the one where you separate out the literary and the...
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's covered for the moment then. Okay. All right, then can we start going through the annexures and just what we need to give guidance on there. So annexure A, the... this is really just setting out the enforcement mechanism. Was there anything you wanted guidance on in Annexure A? I mean, you set out the under the two schedules, the different processes. It's more of a statement of...
It's a statement of the fact that most personal information regulation has been ex ante regulation. And trying to get people to behave properly, but that there is a moving a tendency towards enforcement.
Yeah.
And if we all agree we are going to make an enforcement committee, and we agree that we're contemplating administrative fines, then that's it.
Yeah, I think the enforcement statement is actually on page 6, paragraph 2.18. But there were no questions.
There's no questions on that one, okay. Then Annex should be, which was the structure. We did deal with it's the one which says at the top annex should be
the right hand corner.
It's information regulator structure. We went through it last time.
Provide the members of the committee with a copy of chapter 5.
October.
No, I don't think.
Can these documents be given back in? You gave them to people not from the committee. I mean, can the members of the committee and the parliamentary researchers and state law advisors get given first preference to these? Who doesn't have from that category of, okay, Ms. Smuts? Okay. Christine, have you got it or not? All right.
And this document, Chapter 5, how is that different from the soft copy?
What is going to be revealed?
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Chair. Chair, on the basis of the previous discussion that we had with the committee, with regard to the stick document that we discussed at the previous occasion, yes, Chair, we prepared you a redrafted version of Chapter 5. We've extracted that from our working document because it's only a few pages. You will note at the top of the first page we've just got our key where we indicate now that amendments as a result of the previous discussion will now be indicated in italic font and will also be highlighted. So on page 2, the only amendments there are just to keep our index aligned to the contents of the bill. So you will note that 39A and 39B propose new provisions, and that deals with the establishment of the enforcement committee and the functions of the enforcement committee. Then what I did on page 3, Chair, was just to remind ourselves that there may be definitions here and there that may apply to this chapter. So I tried to just duplicate them there so that we just keep in mind that if we do amendments that they are still in line or that our definitions are in line with the Chapter 5 context. The first proposed amendment, Chair, is actually to clause 36(1), and that is reflected on page 4 of the document. At the top of page 4, you see paragraph C there. The chairperson of the regulator must be appointed in a full-time capacity and may, subject to subsection 3A, not perform or undertake to perform any other remunerative work during the period in which he or she holds office as chairperson. That, Mr. Chair, is not a drastic amendment, and it's more of a consequential nature as a result of the previous discussion. The more substantive one is now reflected in paragraph D, where we indicate, as you will recall, Chair, our request was that we should make provision for two permanently appointed members in addition to the chairperson who is also then permanently appointed. What we decided to do, and it's a proposal from our side, is apart from the, you will recall we've got full time. My apologies, Chair, full time. Our proposal is that with regard to the two remaining members, it wouldn't hurt to have a provision where they may be appointed in a part-time capacity, but if circumstances require or permit, then the possibility could even be introduced that either one or both of them could be appointed on a full-time basis. So our paragraph D at the top of page 4 then reads as follows. The ordinary members of the regulator, those ordinary members are now the members referred to in subsection 1A Roman 2. ordinary members of the regulator must be appointed as follows. Two ordinary members in a full-time capacity, and then Roman 2, two ordinary members in a full-time or part-time capacity, provided that if one or both those members are appointed in a full-time capacity, such member or members may, subject to subsection 3A, not perform or undertake to perform any other remunerative work during the period in which they hold office as such members. That is
the, as far as the structure of the regulatory is concerned, then the draft to give effect to the request that two ordinary members should be appointed on a full-time basis. The next amendment that you will find, Chair...
There's a typo. When you just explain it, or tell me to take out when I look to me like it wants to, and such members. Must those three words be deleted in Roman 1? The Roman 1. Two ordinary members in a full-time capacity and such members? What?
My subject is 3A.
But then you could,
I think
semicolon and end, yeah.
Sorry, I think you're going to have to look at the proviso at the end, maybe being a separate section, but at the moment it doesn't read well. Two ordinary members in a full-time capacity and such members and may subject to section 3A.
May I make a proposal? I see what you're from saying. I would rather maybe recommend two ordinary members in a full-time capacity who may subject to subsection 3A not perform or undertake to perform any other remunerative.
But then you see you've got two as well, full-time ones, so that's why you put it to apply.
Sorry.
I follow it.
Maybe two full time and two full or part time, and then any full time member may not perform any remunerative work.
Would you prefer that clause thing?
It would be easier than having your provider or not provider, the consultant provider may an option to. It's a provider.
Yeah.
That becomes.
Yes, Chair, but
it's just important that the provider should be added to the part-time or full-time members, the Roman 2 members.
It only applies to the full-time members, not part-time.
We'll have a look at it. We'll have a look at it. Page 4,
we're only looking at the changes that he's made.
Okay, F6, the mentally ill, is to be corrected.
Yeah, but at this stage... We are looking at the ones that he's, the shaded ones, Mario, and we can come back to those later.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, then clause 36 AA, those are merely consequential in nature, maybe just a different wording. But in short, the chairperson must then exercise the powers to perform the duties and functions conferred on and assigned to him or her by the regulator in terms of this Act, and then the Promotion of Access to Information Act. And then paragraph B just deals with the accountability of the chairperson. In other words, that the chairperson is accountable to the regulator. Subclause 2, we have had to adapt that a bit. And at the top of page 6, you will see that we propose a subparagraph A, where we indicate that the members referred to in 36 1D1, those are the full-time members, Chair, must exercise their powers and perform their duties and functions as follows. And this is now where we get the split between the PAHIA and the PPI legislation, to the extent that in Roman 1, one member will be required to exercise those powers, duties and functions in terms of this Act, and in Roman 2, one member in terms of the Promotion of Access to Information Act. Then, in paragraph B, we also decided possibly to keep the options open as wide as possible with regard to the, if I could call them, the part-time members, and that is to say that the members referred to in 36.1d Roman 2 must exercise their powers and perform their duties and functions in terms of either this Act or the Promotion of Access to Information Act, or both. And then, as far as their accountability is concerned, in paragraph C, we indicate that the ordinary members referred to in both paragraphs A and B are, for purposes of exercising their powers and performing their duties and functions, accountable to the chairperson.
I think the purpose of this exercise, I mean, what I was wanting to do with the annexures was identify the issues that you needed direction on so that you could draft. You've gone ahead and drafted on these aspects, which we would, I was intending we would then look at, there was going to be a version 5 coming. So I don't think we need to point out what you've done, rather than us discussing the detail now. So I would have thought you might want to just shorten it to say, okay, we've provided for the conflict of interest aspect there, and then you've made provision for an enforcement committee in which those sections are and things. And then when we go through, and you'll obviously then include this into version 5, and when we go through version 5, we can then look at the detail.
And I think, yes, that's the bottom line of the document itself. Maybe just to then highlight, as far as the enforcement committee is concerned, you will note that in our Connection B document, we also refer to the provisions as it appear in the CASA legislation. So the question that will arise when this will be considered is whether we should expand and provide additional information with regard to how precisely that enforcement committee will work. But with that, Chair, yes, that is then the document that we provided you with.
So that's basically the response on B, and then the issue of the tribunal, there's time to push for it.
No, on the contrary, I will feed on it, because I've been thinking it through again just about, various reasons which I won't bore you with, but the fact is, the regulator becomes a de facto internal admin appeal tribunal, as Ananda and Inke have argued, in some respect, including when a complaint is lodged with them against an information officer's decision to decline information. That now, Chair, is assuming that you do the right thing when we come to the powers, which is yet to be sorted out. But and also in respect of appeals lodged with the regulator against adjudicators of codes, and there are further shortcomings of administrative appeals tribunals. So, but don't forget now that I have seeded a big thing here, so you may have to concede something comparably big, preferably in respect of fire.
All right. So on you see, Mario, what I want, the next meeting will be going through version 5. In what I was wanting to do now with the annexures was to give guidance where it was drafted, where it was needed, version 5. Now, what he's done is, in effect, brought version 5.
Mm.
So I'd rather say, let's look at it.
Yeah, I'm
you've looked at it, yes.
But we discussed it, you left us at the last meeting.
Was this table before I before?
No, we created it by discussion.
Now we've
yes.
got the language.
Yes.
I look at the language, and I think that there is something that can be dealt with so that the next step, when the define correct, the next version may be improved upon. So I was wondering whether you would allow me to make a couple of comments on 39A and 39B.
Look, the problem was you weren't there when you left last time. I'd rather do that next time.
But
start opening it up. I mean, we're going to be putting version 6.
Okay,
but we just took all day on this,
Here there are flaws. If we take all day, the flaws are still here. I mean, it's not a point in not to the next
meeting. Okay, then we've got Annex C, which was the issue of whether there should be administrative fines.
Okay, we probably need to see, again, with a way to accelerate the all these annexes 3 and chapter 5 is predicated on the issue of fire being brought under the regulator or not. Since the beginning of this process, that I kept an ambivalent process and a review of the issue, I ever placed it on the matter. And I'm not going to tell you the reasons, but I am convinced that the FAIA should be brought under, taken away from the Human Rights Commission and brought under the regulator. And that goes to the definition of what the regulator matters, and the process of the FAIA is the regulator.
Yeah. All right, should we take note? And then, but there will be a fight between us a little bit later on. The scope of the, yes.
Can I just come back and
look? No. So you're taking the right position, you may not be able
to take it. Minister, applying to Annex C, I don't think it's possible to predict Minister. It's a question of, I think, putting down options rather than taking a decision, putting down options which can be referred to the full committee.
But do you mean by that you want the options of fines in lieu of or in addition to a further legal action? Or do you mean those kinds of options, or do you mean an option of not having any kind of administrative fines or some form of them? What do you mean? Have you bought into the idea of the fines?
No.
Right.
So the option is enabling provisions to have fines, to allow fines.
Starting with the simple thing, do you want fines to be considered in respect of privacy or privacy and fire? In the UK, it's only privacy. It's not, and fire doesn't perhaps lend itself to administrative fines. You guys are not fining the government department when they don't give you information, are you? And you raise a difficulty with that. So different, of course, than claiming damages against them, but still. So, I mean, you're asking the chair now to write a very long, very long string of options.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not worried about the inclusion of the administrative fines. But was thinking maybe the worst sense, then, I mean, you could have a thing of saying, well, you know, from my side, no administrative fines. From the other member's side, what would you want, if you wanted them to find, what would you want to put in? And that's why I was thinking maybe the solution would be an enabling provision, a shorter enabling provision, allowing the regulator to move towards that area.
But if you want my set of choices from the questions, I can give them to you as well. I would confine it to privacy, to the PPI. And the B, I would stick with Roman 2, failure to comply with the compliance notice. Yeah, but and in my case, I wouldn't say it's in lieu of, you hit them with both. Should the non-payment constitute an offence? Yes. May a transgressor be prosecuted for contravention of a statutory provision in addition? Yes. And to whom should the fine be paid? I would say the National Revenue Fund or the regulator. I mean, I'm in favour of starting to give this money back to people, but then you would have to think quite carefully about which functions would you allow the regulator to use the money for. And and maybe in the short term just send this back to the National Revenue Fund.
Maybe just on that point, that's exactly the concern that we have as far as administrative bodies are concerned, public bodies are concerned. Our proposal would have been to say rather to let that funds accrue to the regulator. Well, that's also open for discussion. We could, that's something that we can address. You can't tell banks they're not going into the National Revenue Fund.
You can.
It's unless in exceptional circumstances legislation allows it. So I'm not sure, I'm at the loss as anyone else, what the exceptional circumstances means. That's Section 75 of the Constitution. But I would be hard pressed to believe that these are exceptional circumstances.
Mario, what's your position on the
transition? Can I get back to you?
Okay, but then I think from a drafting point of view, look, I think you've heard in this master's position, and I believe that it only applies to privacy matters, not to access to information. So if you can try and draft some kind of option, without trying to deliberate on it now. I mean, I think she's at least limited some of the areas. But my fear, for example, would be, my fear with administrative fines is basically you've got to have an infrastructure to be able to do things. And from a cost point of view, you want to avoid a sector of tribunals, because otherwise, if officials can levy administrative fines that potentially unfair, then it's suggested. So hence I would rather see the court fining people. And once you've got the provision, you've got to have an appeals mechanism as well. And so if you take, for example, an administrative fine for a failure to comply with compliance notice, I mean that's potentially a criminal offense. Why do we need a administrative fine for that? I mean, that's basically what you're... Well, yeah, maybe let's try and discuss it, because your answer being was okay, what else are the fines then, therefore? Because there were two options, two possibilities, given failure to notify or failure to comply with compliance notes. You said no to compliance notes. So that's already subject to criminal sanction. And my fear is, if you've got an official, whether it's the regulator or the enforcement committee or whatever, in order for them to penalize, I mean, I know I heard the petition last time around how the movement is towards administrative fines, because the goalposts keep moving, keep shifting. But in my mind, you need a tribunal system to have a
And that's what you have numerous laws in
this country. But the bottom line is, you want to find something that's already criminal.
No, I
don't
know.
Can I take you from a different box? And this is my opinion. I'm going to talk to you later, but I think this is fine. What we're looking at is the sanctuary relations. How do you deal with safety with the law that after that? And I would do without any administrative plan if we can strengthen the city's remedy. And I would, once we get there, that's clause 94, I'll give you some suggestions that seem to be a little bit. If we can strengthen the armor for the citizens who have been agreed, motivate private action, either through reinforced travel damage, or for the security of acting in the family community or a certified class, then that would be, which is a typical consumer protection mechanism. And here we are dealing with the violation of private that may be much better speak to the overall enforcement mechanism by creating an army of self-motivating and motivated enforcers than in the administrative time. So I would gladly say that the administrative time is the capital of business that we need to be able to do in Nigeria.
Okay, but I mean that's also then going to be looking at version 5, so you raise it at that point. But just for the purpose of version 5, I mean, Dean, what do you want from in your time?
Well,
actually,
having
the
seat of the tribunal, that now says I'm left with the committee in fact to confuse their fines about the tribunal.
Okay, I will come up with the proposals for Ms. Smuts, and I think it will do the trick. But just to quickly explain, you will have to approach the matter in similar fashion to what the police did. An administrative fine being imposed, you immediately avoid appeals or reviews to the extent that you leave the discretion to the individual. If the individual does not want to pay the administrative fine, the case is handed over to the NPA for prosecution. If the individual pays the fine, then that's the position.
That's why the
that's the intent.
Yeah, but where
does
the guy doesn't want to pay?
If the citizen doesn't want to pay the fine and wants to challenge it, where does he go? No, it doesn't work like that. You imposed a fine.
Yes.
You've got the discretion to pay the fine. If you're not satisfied with the fine or for whatever reason you don't want to pay the fine, then a prosecution will be instituted against you. That's the bottom line.
Well, you see, this is where I've got a problem. My understanding of the fine is that it's a way of settling what a prosecution which has already been instituted. And the most typical example of fines is the fines we pay for traffic violations. The policeman stops you. At that point, he starts a procedure against you. You are charged with the offense at that very point, and there is the option for a fine to settle that offense. So the fine operates to extinguish a procedure which has already been instituted. You don't pay the fine, then the matter goes to court, and the court can confirm the fine or can have an additional sanction imposed against you.
Yeah, but that's,
it's basically it would have to be in lieu of a criminal case. So you have the option of you can settle this without going to court by just simply paying your fine.
Yeah.
If you don't want to, then they will take you to court.
Yeah.
You don't go to court.
No, exactly. But in that mechanism, you can go to court and say, hey, I'm not responsible, guilty, liable.
No, it's basically the other way around. You don't pay, they take you to court. The onus is on them. And then you say to the court, okay, you argue the case on the merits, yeah.
Semantics, but the action has already been, the procedure has already begun at the very moment in which you become liable for a fine, and the fine is assessed against you, and the fine is the mechanism through which that is assessed and finalized and settled.
Okay, I mean, but in terms of where we're then going on this, Dean, if I can represent you, it would seem if you want administrative fines, it would the only way in our current dispensation would have to be in lieu of a criminal conviction. I mean, what Henk has said, not Bush. So I don't know then if you want, and Mario, you remember you said you still want to think about it. It's more.
I'm thinking aloud if you allow me to. See, what are we trying to do here?
I think that the entire thrust of this legislation was to prompt compliance. We want to get people to bring themselves into comply. It is accepted that there is going to be other resistance or neglect because we are imposing obligations on people which are not part of their core function. It's not their business that we're imposing obligation on how they should go about doing their business. So the administrative fine, might be a way to give them a warning the first time around or the second time around to prompt a greater measure of compliance without resorting to criminal action.
I mean, my problem is the public bodies aspect of you go and find somebody or you go and find a specialist case in the hospital. Nursing or counsel for not looking after their information. And the municipality then asks for more money from the revenue fund to pay the fund and to continue providing services. That's it. But as far as version 5 of this draft, what do we want? You have an interest in the fine. Can you think of
we'll certainly bring something that is worthwhile considering, but in our research we got into a quagmire.
Yeah.
That's the bottom line.
Okay, I think for version 5 then, can you, I think don't go into the whole issue of the question as to, the question as to where it gets paid to, because we may decide not to have a version 5. Rather look at a responsible think about things. It would have to be, it's limited to CPI, and it would be your proposal of pre-criminal, in lieu of criminal prosecution, and obviously then non-payment is not in the thing, because you then just go to court. I don't know if you can limit it to one or two proposed sections, then you I don't think it's necessary to would you agree at this stage to go and look at
of information governance consultant.
I'm going to go to the next one.
I'm even with you for old age like that.
Okay, then we've got to deal with Annexure D, which is on the PIA enforcement. Now, there were effectively, there are different options in the document, starting from page 4. Mirror the sort of complaints process handling of the regulator in the PPI bill in terms of PIA. Option 2, providing new powers of complaints handling of the regulator in terms of PIA. And then variations under option 2 with retaining internal appeals or replacing them with compulsory appeals to the regulator or an option to choose either. My question last time was relating to the issue of why or how much are the magistrates' courts being used to deal with PIA disputes. I understand, Christine, that the regulations came into effect last year, November last year. Ms. Tilly, this is a technical committee, so you are free to talk. Maybe I can ask you, and if I've ambushed you, apologies, but if you know offhand, what is the situation with the use of the magistrates' court for PIA appeals?
Well, Chairperson, we have found that we are not in a position to use the magistrates' courts despite the introduction of the rules, because although all magistrates' courts were designated as courts in which PIA matters could be heard quite early on, I think in 2003, perhaps, you have to have a magistrate who has had training, and that training has to be approved off the top of my head by the Judicial Services Commission, perhaps, and the Chief Justice. The difficulty with that is that training, we asked for a list at one point from the Department of Justice at which... In fact, not. A friendly letter, which was answered with a friendly response. Had we used PIA, I'm sure we would not have got it. Response from the Department of Justice was that they had in fact stopped designated training in around 2005 or 2006. So there is a significant obstacle to litigating in the magistrates' courts in that you don't know if a magistrate, although you know the magistrates' court itself is designated, you don't know whether the magistrate has been trained. In terms of PIA, we've had it as one of our objectives to try and litigate in terms of PIA, but that's in terms of using the magistrates' court rules. But we found it quite an obstacle in terms of having magistrates available in the courts that are trained and designated.
I mean, look, I think everybody knows what my concerns are. I mean, I agree PIA is not working adequately. But my fear is overburdening the regulator, both financially. I mean, it's a new body we're setting up, both financially and otherwise. I mean, on the issue of the magistrates' courts, I mean, I think it's very useful this comes up. Right before we're doing our budget review process, and we have the department here this week, and it's something we should ask them as to, you know, ask them these questions and why. I mean, they may have stopped designated magistrates for training if the regulations were not ready. That came up with magistrates training for, I think, PUDGA rules, where they've stopped that while there's a dispute over, well, while there are issues to be resolved on the PUDGA rules. That may have been, I'm speculating, I don't know what the case is, Chris, do you know?
I'm also speculating, but the problem that came up here in the school, and I said, Commissioner, around the judicial education is Institute, and because that's not operating, the magistrates aren't being trained.
But, I mean, I think it's quite clear that there needs to be a body doing body that can expeditiously and cheaply do PIA adjudication. Seeing that there was an attempt to make use of the magistrates' courts as accessible courts, should that be abandoned effectively, what I would see this proposal of moving the regulator in? And that's basically my, but then that's linked then, as I said, to my concerns with overburdening the regulator financially and in terms of the cost and also the functions it has to perform. Ananda?
I just to add to the question about the magistrates' courts not being used. I really set my mind to finding out what exactly is happening in the magistrates' courts, and it was extremely difficult, and I was sent from one person to another right across South Africa. What I realized is that Section 91A of the FIRE makes provision for a process that's going to be difficult to actually implement, in the sense that there are so many people involved. There's the head of the administrative region, then there's the magistrates themselves, there's the minister, there's the DG of justice, there's the chief justice, the judicial service commission, the magistrates commission, and then the municipal department. So there are eight different institutions, eight different entities in different sections of government that must all work together in order to make sure that the training of the magistrates get done. And I think that is really one of the major problems, because to get all those people together and have the finances for that and the budget for that is a very difficult task. Because what has happened is that they did some training, the Justice College did some training, then they realized afterwards that the training was not done in accordance with 91A, which says that it must be, the curriculum must be in consultation with the Judicial Service Commission and the Magistrates Commission done by the Chief Justice. And that was not, they just did it on their own. So they had to stop that training. Then the training was taken over by the SAJEI, I'm not exactly sure what the social institute. Yes, he was supposed to do that, and that was, so Justice College informed me that they have not been training magistrates since the 1st of April 2011. But then, when I spoke to the Magistrates Commission about this judicial institute, they said that they were not funded properly, so they could do nothing. So it was sent back to Justice College. But Justice College didn't take it back, because they are under the impression that they are not training magistrates anymore. So now it's sort of hanging in the air, because nobody's actually dealing with the training of the magistrates. I also spoke to the head of office in Johannesburg as well as in Durban, and they told me that the people were supposed to be going on training on a number of occasions. They were almost going, and then it was stopped because of budgetary reasons. Because the Act also says that the head of the region must, within available resources, designate at least one presiding officer for each magistrate. So resources is also important, and it doesn't seem to be a priority. So I think that although we have this problem at the moment, specific problems, and it seems as though no magistrate has been trained properly in accordance with the law, and that accordingly nobody could be designated. But this is a specific problem. But I just think that the whole process is so complicated that it's going to be very difficult to get all of them together, because all of these people must act at the same time with one object in mind. And I think that's going to be a problem. So so that's the position regarding the magistrate's office.
That does really rather answer your question, which on the face of it at first appeared to be a good question, whether the magistrates would actually had not been available so far but were now so available. But clearly they are not. And we are back to the situation where we owe the citizens of South Africa a mechanism where they can go cheaply when they meet with mute refusal or when they are refused information, and the regulator is self-evidently that place. I mean, this now simply underscores the point.
Well, it doesn't, because if one of the issues seems to have been budgetary constraints. It's the same fiscus. And really the magistrates should be cheaper. But, I mean, that's my concern. I do think it's something we should take up with the department this week when they appear. Maybe, Christine, you could speak to Alison and just get down a list of issues that we should be asking them regarding the implementation of that section. There may be a need for, before the end of the year, it's something I'd have to discuss with the chair, but I think after he went to your PIA awards, I just read the comments that he'd made that were in the media, that we have a specific hearing on the non-implementation of PIA. So I think those are some of the things we can look at. You had your hand up, Alison, you wanted to respond on that?
I think that the question for me is really what would happen if, for example, we took that section out entirely in PIA and said that any magistrate could deal with the PIA application, and whether that would deal with the problem. And my answer would be no, it wouldn't deal with the problem, that you would still need. And I think we've demonstrated that we're clearly going to need, in terms of data protection, in terms of international experience, we understand that one of the first things that the regulator will deal with is questions around data, that it will be mostly about personal information. This will mostly be around data. That's going to be one of the first issues that the regulator is going to deal with. The regulator is very unlikely to have to deal with a floodgate, of access to information requests. If you look at the statistics we have, 80% of South Africans know they have a right to access to information, but only 20% of them know that there's something called an Access to Information Act. So the likelihood of there being a large number of requests for information which will swamp the regulator, we think that what will swamp the regulator in its first years are in fact issues around personal data, and that only very slowly will you start to build up a significant caseload in terms of requests for information, and that caseload, it does not seem internationally, we haven't come across a regulator who said we were simply unable to cope with the number of requests that have been made. And that's, both in countries in the north where the regulators have been established for much longer, but also in the south where you're looking at countries like India and Brazil. We think that the regulator having jurisdiction is a good idea, even if magistrates' courts were to have unfettered jurisdiction in relation to PIA.
The problem then is what is required to give the regulator the ability to adjudicate PIA disputes.
What is required that is such a cost impediment? And may I just add to that? You know that under your constitution, any one of us has the right of access to information in the hands of the state, and that the qualifying subsection 2 says, for the purposes of cost and administrative convenience, a law will be written, which is why the PIA. But where is the argument for saying I can be denied my right of access to information in the hands of the state because it's now too expensive?
Well, you're not, but at the moment it's with the High Court. I mean, the High Court is the only body adjudicating on PIA disputes at the moment, and the problem with that is cost of access by ordinary people. But there's no exclusion of that right. What we're looking at doing is trying to make it more accessible, and hence the magistrates' courts, because they're cheaper to access. It's going back to the document. My concern is, have we explored why the existing system is not working properly with regard to the magistrates' court, and what can be done to fix that? And the fact that I think the bill does provide for the regulator, I can't remember, Ananda, what's the section where the regulator has to investigate this issue?
Section 80 of fire.
But look, I mean, my concern is still the thing of the aspect of the work provisions made for cheaper adjudication of prior disputes which are not working. Have we adequately looked at why and can they be fixed, or is it a simple matter of disregarding them? That's the one aspect. Then as far as Annexure D and the moving to version 5, there are different options which maybe we should then go through. I mean, I think from the ANC side, the issue of costs and implementability would need to be looked at. But for the purposes of the other members of the committee, I think we should go through the options in Annex D and see what you want.
Can I throw something?
Yeah.
Considering the difficulties that we have heard and the overall state of the judicial system, especially in point of cost, should we make provision, should we consider making provision for alternative dispute resolution? Without those provisions, ADRs would not be available in a subject matter of this nature because the state cannot enter into such a process. We've been engaged in trade and industry on a bill on the amendment of intellectual property law, where the consideration there was to enable indigenous communities, which were seen as vulnerable segments of the population, to have access to justice in a manner which was not expensive, difficult, etc. And there we enable the relevant organ of state, at the request of the indigenous community, to resort to ADRs. Just a thought of whether that's something worth considering.
Chairman, just coming back to the issue of costs, and again, I'd like Alison probably to respond to this. My impression in reading about the various jurisdictions is simply the intervention on requests for access to information of a regulator has meant that in a lot of cases, those requests which have just been refused because it's just somebody who's come in, the regulator itself carries some power in actually ensuring that those requests are met. And in very many circumstances, that's negating the necessity for either citizens to go to court, and very often the response to that, well, but now they're going to court. We have to respond to this by defending ourselves. And I think that's I couldn't honestly say to you that there's scientific evidence around it. It is an impression that maybe Alison has a closer view on.
Maybe just before Alison, I mean, just to respond to this as well. I mean, from what's really following on from Mark's point and from Mario's, the real disputes where government has information that it does not want to release, government or a private body has information that they don't want to release, will probably go to the High Court, because the body holding the information has the power to keep appealing to which whatever lower structure makes the decision. The problem seems to be more a issue where information officers do not apply their minds properly to the release of information. So if I'm following Mark correctly, we've been talking about the regulator adjudicating in prior disputes. Maybe that is not the correct word. Where adjudication, I'm thinking off the top of my head, adjudication could be and maybe should be then sent up to the courts, and we need to get the magistrates' courts working so that they can adjudicate. Because to adjudicate, you need a substantial infrastructure to be able to hear the case. It's a judicial, quasi-judicial function. To hear the case, to apply, you know, to have the parties being able to make representations and so on. And that's my fear about the regulator being overburdened. Is there not some way, following on from what Mark says, of not giving the regulator adjudicatory powers, but giving them some kind of interventionist powers? And I don't know how one would phrase it. So is there not either of the two options that you've outlined, because those are adjudication options, but more interventionist options? And how would one do that in law? So that's the thing. I mean, Dee, do you want to come now, or do you want Alison to respond, or?
No, just to say that, I mean, usually you would find that phrase of mediation, conciliation, et cetera, under the Human Rights Commission Act. But we want something stronger than that.
We want intervention rather than mediation.
Right.
No, I'm not.
I still think they should adjudicate, but.
Well.
Okay, Mario. They can't adjudicate. You need to be able to go to court at one point. So the judicial adjudication cannot take place within the regulator for self-evident constitutional reasons. What mediation or conciliations are not things that necessarily help people. The arbitration type, the alternative dispute resolution mechanism should be basically based on arbitration. So that MTEP can be not a replacement but an equivalent of a judicial process.
You see, my fear with arbitration is, again, that is it's time consuming and it's costly. You've to make a decision in an arbitration, you've got to hear both sides, you've got to have both parties before you. It's quite formalistic. I think the problem is, and this I'd look then again to Alison, is what we're actually dealing with, are we not, is the matters where there's just no response from the information officers. And what one is looking for maybe is a provision allowing the regulator to intervene. Without becoming an arbitrator or an adjudicator. I don't know what you...
To answer the question directly, I think the example that we've looked to really on this one is Canada, where the regulator for many years was a man called John Reed, who had recommendation powers. And eventually, at the point that he stepped down, which was in the last 6 or 7 years, he stepped down. He was of the view that recommendation powers were not sufficient because he felt, and this is dealing with an entirely different culture, and one must recognize that, but he felt that he was being ignored. His powers of recommendation were not sufficient. And he was making recommendations and they were not being carried through, and he didn't have a mechanism for making structures accountable for him. So it meant that his recommendations were basically falling on deaf ears. You might argue that as a that you would look at some kind of mediation powers, the right to call for the documents, the right to view the documents, the right to give an opinion on the documents. I mean, we've certainly heard from the Commissioner in Western Australia that a lot of issues in their jurisdiction is resolved simply by 30A calling for the documents, reading them, and then issuing a draft opinion to the agency concerned, saying, you know, we've had a look at the documents and this is what we would say if we were to go to a full arbitration. So there are steps short of arbitration which are useful and which can result in resolving the dispute. Ultimately, I think what officials are looking for in South Africa, from our research, is that the officials are looking for some kind of risk management policy from their side. It's too risky for them to release information. They simply are too concerned about getting into trouble. What they need is some kind of document that they can have, that they can put in the file, that they can say, I was told that I had to release this information, and therefore I released it, and therefore I can't be held responsible. There was somebody who's more important than me and more important than you, speaking to whoever their superior is, who has said that this information must be released. We think it's inevitable that if there is a really serious dispute about information, that the matter will go to courts, and you know that's where you get the jurisprudence in other jurisdictions that do have dispute resolution structures. So there's never going to be a situation where there's no matters going to court. We do know that they say that the number of matters that go to court are fewer, obviously, or perhaps not so obviously, but that they are able to resolve issues at that level. I mean, certainly the Scottish Information Commissioner is of the view that, you know, a lot of the issues that are brought to him, he says everybody's argument always ends in and somebody's going to die. That's always the argument from the government institution. If you release the information, something terrible is going to happen. And he says eventually that once you've worked through what the actual information contains, that very often you are able to show that that is simply not true and that the terrible consequence is not going to happen and that therefore then there's agreement on releasing the information. So it seems that good information commissioners do a lot of mediation, but the question is, to what extent is that because they have the powers to back them up, which they could use if they chose to, or is it simply, is mediation simply, you know, the what you need and you don't need anything else? Certainly the what we've been told is that the purely recommendation powers are weak, and you will find your information commissioner is in certain circumstances ignored. You might argue that those are the cases when you have to go to court. Not as far as I know.
And then looking, I mean, I don't know if you've got Annex D, but there's a sort of chart relating to the bottom of page 8, which reflects that, okay, I don't know, it doesn't have Canada as having an information commissioner, it's got Canada down as an ombudsman.
Yeah, that would be a commissioner with recommendations.
With recommendations. So ombudsman's basic, ombudsman, men?
Ombudspeople.
No, it's not a, I know this for a fact, it's from, I think, Swedish, so the man does not apply to a male.
Yes, but we're
speaking. Okay, anyway.
It's a ruling
on this. Well, it's not a ruling, I'm just pointing out that it's not like a chairman. It's the word M-A-N comes from something else other than that. But,
the word chairman, the word comes from Manu.
Anyway. Ombudsmen are, or ombudspeople, make recommendations. So that would be Australia, Canada, New Zealand. The Information Commissioner in Ireland and the United Kingdom. Ananda, I think you did this. Do they have directive powers? But you've also got a tribunal and courts in the UK, according to this. And how does the Information Commissioner in the UK make a decision around a access to information request?
I think it happens in our government to signal this information is related to action policy on page 24. And then you do the assessment, the enforcement notice, information notice, decision notice, practice recommendation, negotiation, monitoring, advocating, security policy.
And then, but the policy is not enforceable.
The same, I see Elbert in exactly the same fashion as the DPA. The information actually is part of it. It's a mirror of the
bubble. That's
right.
Can
I ask you why, Mario? We have for years in this country, through the Chapter 9 review, through all of it, said we want a regulator that can make binding orders. Why do you say now that they can't?
Because in terms of the Constitution, at a certain point, at the end of the road, you must be able to go to an independent judge who is part of the judiciary. Unless you choose voluntarily to go to an alternative method of dispute resolution.
No, that doesn't mean you can't create mechanisms in which you can ultimately go and appeal to the High Court and beyond. But that doesn't mean you
can't. No, absolutely.
We've created any number of tribunals.
Absolutely. But eventually,
well,
you've got to be able to go to the court.
But that doesn't answer the issue we're discussing, which is that South Africans need a place, a regulator, where citizens can go, where that person can rule, it can make a binding order that such and such information must be released.
I agree.
From my side, I would like to explore the issue of the regulator not arbitrating or adjudicating, but playing some kind of interventionist role. How that would be structured and how one would word that, I don't know. And then we look at beefing up the, or ensuring that the provisions relating to the adjudication in the magistrates' courts are implemented. So as far as my concern of some kind of role, interventionist role for the regulator, I can't think of any wording, but I don't know. I mean, Mark, you suggested it. I don't know if you've got any proposals, but Hink and Amanda, if you can also look at something, and Alison, if you can also make some submissions, but sort of soon. Then from the other members of the committee side, maybe just to put it, you've got option one. Okay, you want the regulator, Dean. Yes, now you've got option one and you've got option two. Do you want option one? Four.
Yeah, I don't know if some feelings, but I mean, I actually think that you can, I did it once before, you can plug the biofunctions into the same. But I must say, I think it would be more satisfying to have a separate provision saying how we regulate. Unless the framework number would be in some sort of other kind of process. It's easier to write, to slice a fire provision into your information notice that you're enforcing that to that extent. Is it easier to write a separate?
I think we've already done the drafting for the written affiliation, so we can just pull out the ones that you want. Outcome, page 20. The idea with the option one, the mirroring, and option two, the new powers, it's not that they will be in the same act. The fire enforcement will be in fire and the CPI in CPI anyway. Because at the moment, the structure of the act says that the regulator will enforce fire in terms of chapter 5 of fire. So it's everything that changes or doesn't change will in any way be in fire. So it will be dealt with separately in two separate acts anyway, irrespective of what you put of the details. So in the one option, it will be a direct mirroring of the position in the CPI. So it will be the enforcement notice that's in terms of. In option two, it will be new powers of complaint, and that will really be similar to the internal appeals it's the same sort of thing, but it has been done already.
All right.
I
don't have to choose.
So for the purposes of version 5, would you then just be putting in schedule D3.
Yes. If it's just like when you get to the variations, then it gets more complicated because you now there are three variations, two options for three variations, so you can have all of the variations in the different options. That's why we didn't go that far. So if you could have just choose one of the variations, that would make it easier.
Eating in a position to choose a variation.
The one is it's just putting the internal appeals. The second one is replacing this with compulsory appeals directly to the regulator, and then the third variation, which is the one that we thought was the best one, is the voluntary system where you just add the what the regulator as an option.
So you're working on variation three. Okay. Alright, so as far as version 5, you will redraft schedule D3 to follow variation 3.
Yes, sir.
And that would be down as an option. And then from my side, if you can look at whether there's anything that can be done not to give the regulator adjudicatory powers or arbitration powers, but to give them a power to... Because I do think that Alison's summary of assessment of why information often isn't forthcoming probably is a very accurate one. Mm-hmm. Officials not being clear around what to do, needing some kind of direction to tell them so that they feel safe.
Especially, Chair, if you remember what the Chairman of Justice once told us, that an order had gone out from government to all government departments to stop giving any information whatsoever upon any kind of request following a certain judgment, which he didn't identify. It may have been the Zimbabwe SDA case. But the Chairman of Justice said in public, and more than once, that there is an instruction not to give any information. So, A, it's shocking, and to be condemned, but B, it does support that argument. You're going to need to give people some moral support before they will start giving what they want.
I think maybe one can perhaps look at the Human Rights Commission Act and the powers of the Human Rights Commission in terms of that act, not in terms of fire, or wording for something
as... Is that what we're going to do?
Yes, but...
Is that fire like that?
It's fire. There are duties in terms of the Human Rights Commission Act and then duties in terms of fire, specific duties in terms of fire. Yes, so maybe we can have a look there, but something that I just want to add to that is what one must remember is that the whole idea of the notice of system is really what they call soft law, because you are just telling someone do something or don't do something or whatever. It's not, and then only if you don't do something and you don't repeat it and you actually do nothing, then you go to court. So it's not, it's because I'm just thinking, if you're not allowed to make that order of telling the responsible party, or what you would put it for the institution, you must give the information, then how are you going to circumvent the problem that Alison has raised? Because that's really what you need. You need somebody to tell the institution, please give the... What they always say is you remind them of his obligation.
Yeah, I mean,
that
I think would
may
be...
But
that's really an enforcement order.
Yeah. But, it seems to me that some of the powers relating to enforcement and justice and all the rest of it would be absolutely opposite for request for full access to information as well. And that, I think, is where the initial power comes in, is that it's not just the person who's requesting, but it's being supported by an institution which has legal recognition. And that seems to, as I say in my reading, the impression that I gained, that's avoided a lot of unnecessary court action and achieved a lot of those objects. I agree that there are certain instances where the entities will go to court.
Address the problem, whether you address it by way of mediation or whatever, or other intervention, it will take the same amount of his time, you know, whether he issues an order or whether he, you know, does take some other action. I don't think it will take less time. If you have to deal with it, you have to investigate it, and you'll have to find out what's going on, if you talk to the people, etc. So,
then the problem is that
exactly the same, it's mirroring the provisions in the CPI Act. Everything that has been done with regard to access to information is done in terms of fire. And everything that's done in terms of privacy is done in terms of CPI. So it's exactly the same that you would find in CPI, but it's just mirrored in fire. This would now be 77A.
Yeah.
In CPI.
Are you including this in the client?
Yes. the support for.
But yet it's not mirroring. The thing on page 39, procedure of regulator. Regulator may, after receipt of the application, may written responses referred in the clear oral representations made by the parties and permit such parties to be assisted by legal representatives or other advisors.
Sorry, I'm not
picking up. Yeah, you can use one on page 39.
Are you on page 21? One really is the mirroring.
Let's get back to you, because it's putting options into the text. Let's get back to you and give you a report.
Option 1 is
to know option three, variation three.
D3, that's option one. Yes. That's option one.
Option
and
one there.
Okay. Then I think we're largely done in the D3 here.
Are we going to perhaps look at the other submissions?
We have one.
We skip and.
I didn't get the.
I haven't. Well, if I did, I didn't.
That's the one about Pam. I don't know. Are you particular?
We'll
receive the phone number. Dr. Schneider is something we want to be writing.
We'll do a verbal description.
Well, maybe just start with what the issues are, and then rather than just making it more.
Mix it, and I must admit, I'm not sure whether, can I just borrow your most recent question? Their concern, in short, is that they compare, now this is the document submitted by the Eastern York Stewart Incorporated on behalf of Mix It, where you will recall that we are talking about the information of children being special personal information. And that we have proposed an amendment in terms of clause 25 where the permission of a competent person is required before the information of a child, personal information of a child can be processed. Now, on behalf of MIXIT, it was pointed out that this is going to cause concerns or it raises concerns with them because in their view a person under 18 can therefore not contract and therefore not participate or become part of MIXIT. Their proposal is that the age should be reduced in sync with other countries, for example in the United States. If I remember correctly, they pointed out to us that the age is 13. So in other words, if you're older than 13, you would be able to transact by becoming part of MIXIT on your own accord without parental permission, parental consent. I also aim to argue that introducing a requirement of or requiring your the competent person to consent to your personal information being processed is not effective in protecting the personal information of the child, and that they would rather recommend that special measures be taken and introduced to protect the information of the children. But the one thing that they do not point out to us is where whether they transact legally at this stage with children. Because you will recall our proposal in clause 25 is not to amend the substantive law insofar as the ability of a child is concerned or a younger child is concerned to consent to a transaction in respect of him or herself. We merely confirm the existing position. And that, in short, is and I don't know whether you've received now a copy of the document, not yet. Mr. Chairman, you remember that I made a submission on this point, and I've since conducted some additional research. My submission was that we must differentiate, even though everyone below the age of 18 is a child, we must nonetheless create a different category, and for purposes of this act, deal with teenagers, anyone who is 13 or older but younger than 18. At the time, I made a reference to social networks, all the things on the internet on which children constantly subscribe to. My additional research, and I don't have it with me because I did not think that the issue would arise today, indicates that there is an enormity of educational opportunities out there, from science talk shows on the internet to educational opportunity, all of which children, teenagers, are strongly encouraged to participate. And they all collect personal information. In that they ask for name, age, schools they're attending, and at times they ask some personal information on what classes they've taken, all of which are personal data within the definition of this bill. It would be absurd in the year 2011 to expect a child to be unable to interact himself or herself with his sites and request that his or her parents' consent to do so. It's now, there is also another dimension. Increasingly more, there is recognition of an area of privacy for teenagers, which may be opposed to their own parents. They have a right of privacy on a variety of issues, and it's been recognized across the world. I'll give you the research, but Amanda knows that where the right of privacy of a teenager can be opposed to a child, to a parent. That creates a juxtaposition, which makes it unreasonable to expect a parent to consent on a matter on which potentially would be within the child's own area of privacy, which includes the right of excluding parents from there. So I really think that we should fear not to change things around just because it departs from the home affairs definition of legal capacity, if we think it's the right thing to do. Legal capacity for transactions of this type, for expectation of privacy, begins at the age of 13. A 13-year-old teenager is entitled to protect his own privacy, is capable of protecting his own privacy, should be educated and encouraged legislatively to protect his own privacy. So I really strongly motivate for that to be inserted, irrespective of being afraid of changing something around. We are just adjusting to the times.
I think we have a problem there. It just seems that from Nick's side, they first of all said that they have a problem in that they also actually don't know whether they are contracting legally, because in South Africa, that's 18 years to constitute you only have legal capacity from the age of 18, and you can have a contract when you're younger than 18 if there are no only rights and no obligations. So that is really a problem for them. The second part of the problem is that they do not have the capacity to really
distinguish who, what the age of a person is, because they don't, they do not have any direct contact between the person who's actually engaging in this user contract with them and themselves. It's all done automatically and, you know, via electronic devices. So it wouldn't actually assist them if we lower the age to 13, because they don't know how old the person is that deal with it. So that's the problem seen from Mixit's solution. They've actually asked for it to be, you know, not to have that at all. So it wouldn't help them if it's 13 years old. However, what they did is they didn't really deal with these issues. They looked at the question of whether the protection of children should be dealt with in terms of the sensitive information like we've done it. And they also looked at other countries and said that they have they don't really provide age restrictions, and they said that there are other ways in which to deal with it properly.
Right. Where's Mr. Mavano?
So we can deal with those issues with which are actually the arguments that they've... I think we will be able to deal with the arguments that they've raised. I don't think those arguments are so good. We can really deal with that. But it brings us back to the original problem. It's the fact that our law actually says that a child cannot enter into a user contract with Mixit or Facebook or whoever. But that is, I agree with Dr. Antipini that that is not the way that the world is working at the moment. However, one should also immediately say that Mixit actually referred us to 8, and there's another 9 studies that are being that have been done in the past few years, I think 5 of them in the last 3 years. So everybody everywhere is very concerned about this, because the first thing is to say, well, all children are doing it, but at the same time, they're also realizing that there are more and more problems associated with it, that we're working with a moving target, it's changing, the position is changing all the time. So it's not so easy to say, okay, do this, that, or the other. But I was actually wondering, it seems to me, I don't think there's anything specifically wrong with the section or the clause that we have in our bill. I think it will actually work quite well. I think the Department of the University of Cape Town, in conjunction with the Children's Institute, has published this. It's the Legal Guide to Age Thresholds for Children and Young People, April 2011, Edition 5. And then it says, at what age can children and young people make decisions and act on their own without assistance from their parents? What are the thresholds, etc.? And it's a whole little booklet, because there are quite a number of different ages for different aspects of a child's life. So this will work very well with our section, because our section will actually work in the way that when you need the consent of your parents, then this will just be a little added strip at the bottom, and they also consent to the processing personal information for this action that's taking place, or contract that you've entered into. So in that sense, I'm not suggesting that the restriction of the bill at the moment is problematic. I'm actually thinking that there's a lacuna in our law insofar as dealing with children's information electronically. And that should actually be addressed. Now, I'm not sure where that should be addressed. I don't think it's really in our law. I think it should be something in the ECT Act or whatever. But I don't also know if we're the ones that should be doing it or not. But I just think that that's a problem, because legally speaking, this is what our law says. Our law says that the child cannot transact if there are any obligations in terms of that transaction. And so actually they are contracting illegally. And it's only because there's nobody regulating it. But now all of a sudden we have a regulator, and the regulator is going to regulate the personal information side of it, which is a small piece of the action. I mean, the actual action is taking place in the chat rooms and wherever, and that's not being regulated at all. So,
what are your recommendations?
well.
May I? Yeah. Let's see. When you need to arrange to bring society, the whole of society under some good rules, I mean, every day there are millions of teenagers who go and order ice cream, they order food in restaurants, and in so doing they contract obligations. And when they order, the food is delivered, they eat it, they must pay for it. And society gets on with it. There is no legal capacity to do any of that. Now we are superimposing a law in which their consent becomes relevant. And we have two options. Either we advance the reality, legality to reality, and we lower this legal, but it's absurd. Or we create another situation where we push people in a situation of illegality. Now, factually, that can take place when people, when teenagers go and order the pizza. It doesn't matter. The common citizen has got better common sense and will sell the pizza and will accept it, not in that. Here it's different. We are in an environment in which it becomes necessary to lower the age. Because there are legal consequences to become of such a nature because there is a regulation, which an entire state of activity becomes prohibited. All that which is aimed at teenagers and teenagers only may not become valid. And I think that that's not what we want to do. We want to protect privacy, not interfere with trade and commerce, education, and social activities of ours from our population.
So, I mean, you literally put up to regulate the rules of our business. And there is a lot of hundreds of
people. Chairman, I think that we've got to put this in context. First of all, Nexus are South African companies. Hence, they want regulation because they could be caught in a situation where they might be penalized. But the fact of the matter is that Mixit, it's an instant messaging service, essentially. It's very cheap and it's attractive, and essentially, it's used by school children predominantly. Sometimes I think it's very educational. But the fact of the matter is that there's a whole generation which have actually got very, very, let's call it the younger Facebook generation, who are not necessarily using Mixit and have never really used Mixit. And you then have this other situation where, as Mario says, we're in a situation where the reality is that it's not just the South African regulator. Because when they contract with Facebook or Twitter or whatever else, they are contracting to the choice of law, which is outside the South African jurisdiction. It's not subject to our regulator, etc. And there might be others. There might be ways of dealing with certain of that. But we are in an area where it is a global problem. It is being wrestled with globally. The whole issue of what the right age is, in some of the countries we're not seeing it being lowered, we're seeing people say, hang on a second, it has been too low. We are not affording our children adequate protection, and we need to afford them better protection. The mechanics and the policing and enforcement of that are issues which nobody has yet been able to resolve. So I think that it's really going to be, and again, I agree with Amanda, I wonder whether it's the right place for this to be. It initially wasn't within the remit of the Law Commission, if I remember correctly, and we were then asked to address it. But let's address it. Let's try and address it. And I agree with Dean that in time we might find the regulator making recommendations to Parliament or whomever to deal with this in a different way. So I would be inclined to rather get us more in line with what is happening internationally, because really, at the end of the day, a lot of our children's information is not going to be in the control of our regulator in any event.
What is the implication of this? What happens to my
Well, COPPA, the American legislation is 13. I think the UK is 12, and then Andy, you said Scotland was 16, I think it was.
What is the Data Protection Act, maybe I need to have a look at that, is to say that because there's a difference in age, that they, for the purposes of the DPA, they would regard the age as 12. So they've actually lowered the age in Scotland for the purposes of this.
Australia is 13.
Just for the purposes of this act?
Oh, just for the purposes
of
the
DPA. Any
form
of
a child
in Scotland that would usually not be able to processing up to the age of 12. Because they've
or is it linked to social media?
By the way, we've had much of this conversation before now, and decided we didn't want to get into territory that has not been resolved anyway, in fact. And that's why we ended up. Mark does a lot of work in this field. Ananda and Henk are also very interested in that. We've had this whole conversation before.
Chairman, thank you very much indeed. And this is a particular debate in the European Union, because there is no actual age in the European Union. The only time there is a debate, it was fixed at 13, in a code of practice, in fact. But this is questioned. In Spain, the age of consent, I think, is 11. And some other countries, higher, Scotland, changed its rule. I think the question is twofold. Firstly, it's a question of when can you consent to the processing of your data. Now that's one very important thing, Facebook, all these things which are free. And surely at that stage you really need to do it at a very early age because of education. One thing you might consider is changing, or rather adding, not just parents or guardians but also teachers. So you get over some of this problem, possibly. The second thing, of course, is actually consenting to buying something. And the difficulty there, as a lot of research has shown, is that children know the numbers of their parents' Visa card or their ID numbers.
Their own personal information. So there's no purchasing, there's no creating obligations to the third party, there's no communication. And it's something that children should be able to deal with. And it's not permanent, it's not an enormous damage. If they're giving away their personal information and still at the time in which they have no bank account, they have not created cards of their own. What I do know is that the agenda of protecting the youth, the quality of youth for the moment, is very from the execution of soccer.
This is
I think it's time to read you this now from the DPA. It says, where a question falls to be determined in Scotland as to the legal capacity of a person under the age of 16 years to exercise any right conferred by any provision of this Act, that person shall be taken to have that capacity where he has a general understanding of what it means to exercise that right. That's one. And then two, without prejudice to the generality of subsection 1, a person of 12 years of age or more shall be presumed to be of sufficient age and maturity to have such understanding as is mentioned in that subsection. So that's what that is the way they brought Scotland into the fold. But that would mean then that you will then choose a certain age, in this case 12 years, which would then, a person of that age would then be regarded to have the capacity to exercise any right conferred by the CPI. So you choose 12.
we didn't want to choose a specific age because there's so much difference in what the capacity of children, the capacity of children, for instance, to have an abortion. There's no age limit.
Did you chose an age of 18?
Well, that's the definition of a child.
Yes.
Yeah. We didn't choose it. I mean, that is
the way that it's drafted.
The age of
The child is going to be law is 18. But in terms of the purpose of the bill, by requiring having this provision related to children, a choice to take to be was made at 18.
The top age is 18, but that's not the problem. It's really the bottom age that's the problem. Because, I mean, children, that's just saying who children are. But I mean, now, if you know who children are...
Not processing 251C, not processing certain information concerning a child. Because the definition of the word child we use is defined under 18.
The example that we use is
legally speaking, you're allowed to open your own bank account at the age of 16. So that's already a deviation from our general definition of what a child is, of any person under the age of 18 years. And that's why we propose to amend that clause, is to ensure that wherever the law stipulates a lower age for you to have the capacity to transact, and I'm specifically not using the word contract, I'm using the word transact, then you will not require the permission of your parent, well, not your parent, a competent person. So, and the abortion legislation is another example. I'm not sure what the age there is, but let's say it's 14. The reality is that in no country, and so it's becoming in South Africa, there is no unified notion of age or majority. The consent, relevant legal consent is the same for the activities. You've got one age of consent, which is the residual one, the default one, 18. But you may have an age of consent which is lower, for instance, for relevant consent for sexual activities, below which there is statutory rape, to undertake an abortion. So it's perfectly conceivable and in line with the reality, both legal and factual reality of the country, to have an age of consent for purposes of disposing of and administering your personal data, your phone numbers, whatever it is. And if I look at, for instance, the United States, there is the relevant ages, they go from 11 years old to drinking ages, which in some states are 21, in other states are 16, driving age, which is 16, voting age, which is 18. And you will remember President Mandela was suggesting a voting age of 14. So the entire notion of a unified age of consent no longer exists, and it's becoming more and more fragmented. And this is an additional step in this direction, which is a necessary one, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, the way I read the law at the moment is prohibition on processing of special personal information, the responsible party may subject to 25A, which is the provision relating to consent, not process personal information regarding a child. In those circumstances where that child is not legally competent without his assistance of a competent person. And the child's purpose of 25.1 is 18.
Yes.
Now, are we then not... there is an issue of we're not criminalizing. If somebody does not criminalize, thus the regulator to go into the issue an enforcement notice but effectively, what this is doing is saying, okay, all the processing on mixes is not allowed. We're making legal
You see, the what the Act actually says is that any person under the age of, you're not allowed to process the personal information of a person under 18 in those circumstances where that person of 18 years old is not legally competent without the assistance of the person. So now you've got this little booklet and it tells you what the child is doing, what the circumstances are for each action. Yes. Your own will at 16, a witness to a will 14, litigation 18. No, but that is why there's a lacuna, not in our bill, but in the Electronic Communications Act, which should have dealt with that issue, but it hasn't.
Okay, but the rule is coming from our end.
There is a default age.
No.
The default age is 18, so there is no lacuna. Unless we provide for, with the default age is 18, then there are special pieces of legislation, opening bank account, et cetera, which will give it a 16. So if we say nothing, we stick with the language you just read, in order for Mixit to run its business or anyone else in the same position, they would need to have the consent of the parent if a child is involved. We have the power to write it in any way we want it if we think it's necessary and reasonable.
Can I just say that it's not us stating the rule. The rule is there, we're just following the rule. So the rule is there, for instance, for abortion. You can
You're making a rule that you shan't process the personal information of a child without their parents, a child being a person under the age of 18 without their parents' consent. That is the rule we're making.
No, you see, we're not making that rule. We are following the rule that says a child may not contract on his own without their consent. And we're just following it. But the child may, it's very close. In that instance, the two processing of the information and actually making use of the user agreement with Mixit is very close. But take abortion. I mean, our law says that a child of 10 years old can have an abortion if it's possible. Now, if we say, if you allow, if say for instance we say let's
now,
make
the
age.
You're following the issue of okay, where the child, you know, the legal competency, you're allowing that to vary.
Yes.
But the difficulty, as I would see it, is the effect of this is that the person responsible party may not process personal information concerning a child where that child is not legally competent. And so one takes the existing everything there. But it's a new rule that we're imposing. Don't process personal information. So we're not saying the existing law is, you know, when a child can enter into a contract. Okay? That's the existing law.
Yes.
Our new law is that you can't process personal information of a child. So it is a new aspect. And it then becomes something that you can't do. With the reality being that it's being done all the time.
The issue here, if I may just interject so you can answer me, the issue here is at what age consent becomes legally recognized. You say for purpose of abortion, the consent of any minor is legal, because if you do it without her consent, it's assault. For purpose of sexual intercourse, the consent of a minor becomes relevant, because there is no consent, it's rape. For purposes of opening a bank account, the consent of a minor is relevant, because there is a special piece of legislation. As the Germans say, there is a new activity here. We protect personal information and the right of privacy attached to it. And we give the consent to lessen the protection, to allow for our data to be processed. At what age is that consent relevant? As we write the new rules, as we create the new protection, without departing from any existing rule, which we would have the right to do, nothing stops anyone from departing from existing rules. But without departing from existing rules, we can surely write, together with the regulations, at what age it becomes relevant to express consent. I mean, I don't see what the problem is.
If we take out this fiction completely from our board, and there's now no indication of what the child could do or not could do or whatever when the information is needed, Mixit will still be contracted illegally.
But I mean,
I don't think on the face of it we can pass something like this, which just automatically is just unimplementable. Okay? But to my mind, there is a need to protect the processing of personal information of the child, although I would see a difference between the child processing personal information on Nixit and a child giving personal information to some data collector who gives them cell phone in response to being able to compile a database of personal information relating to that child. To my mind, the issue is not dropping the age, it's more the activity. But I think for me the way out is that we can keep this restriction. It is up to the regulator to enforce it. So what we would need to do is put in a clause that the regulator needs to examine. I don't know, there's different options that have come up. I mean, Dean suggested the issue of the regulator, this came up on your side first, under the regulator investigates and reports to Parliament. But I would have thought that not so much reporting to Parliament, I mean, it could, but it's more that this still comes into effect now. What happens with all these sites? If somebody makes a complaint, there is a restriction. But to enforce that restriction, it's got to be a complaint to the regulator. If somebody makes such a complaint, we need to give some kind of powers to the regulator, some kind of flexibility to the regulator, to be able to decide what to do. And so what I'm suggesting is a clause in this section, we keep the section as it is, but there is a proviso that empowers the regulator to, in considering maybe to specify social networking types, or whatever the word used to describe it, not the site or computer, mixed with the phone, that in determining whether there's been a breach in the process of the person's information due to take these factors into account. Something like that. So we don't get onto the Mario's issue of the age, because I think that's a problem.
Yeah, but
13 is 11.
You can't get around it, because you never default that without constraints, you can't do it. Only an adult can be constrained. And those who are not allowed to retire their parents. This is the law. So against this, if you write, well, that the regulator is going to report to us whether or not there is a problem with the law being acted, well, it's a report you make.
This is not the law in the sense that it is not a crime to do this.
Well,
it
is
you
cannot collect, and you cannot profit, and profit means everything, collect, blah, 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 blah. You cannot collect information without the constraint of the legal sanction.
But it is up to the regulator to enforce it. So you can go and process the information, but the only way it can be stopped, you can't be prosecuted for the information.
Yeah, we're writing a law, we are telling the regulator to stop
it. Yes, that's
then
why
you
I'm
can
saying we need the solution would be to put in a clause,
don't enforce the
giving the regulator flexibility.
Why do we need to appear of our
No, but I don't think you're a bird in the forest. Your son is very small.
Chairman, I think that this debate reflects exactly the type of problem that is being faced globally. And you have a situation, I think it was reported last week or the week before last, that there are 800 million users of Facebook. Many, many of those are under 18, and they say only a small number of Facebook, say only a small number are under 13. But the fact of the matter is the issue of enforcement and policing is very difficult without the cooperation of the social networking agencies. The other issue that I think is being missed in our debate is, what is the mischief that the Act is trying to prevent? The Act is trying to prevent the abuse of personal information. If one looks at identity theft, which is really at the core of much of cybercrime and the abuse of personal information theft, the issue is, how much information can you... It's not identity theft is not just one instance. It's a process of collating data so that you can masquerade as that person. So, for instance, with Facebook and Twitter, you can virtually have somebody's life history. And that information is being collected. I don't think that we can say that that information is any less. In fact, I think it's far more sinister than the actual collection of names, etc., and addresses in isolation. So, I wish that I had the answers, because I'm sure that I'd be making a lot more money and I wouldn't be sitting here if I did have the answers. But the fact of the matter is that I think that we, it is something that we should address. If we are to align ourselves with the rest of the world, or when, as I say, Facebook, 800 million users, their conditions expressly state 13. They state that because it's subject to the laws of the United States. I'm very inclined to agree with you, because I don't think, you know, we get some 13-year-olds that are very mature and others that are, other 40-year-olds that are very immature. But the fact of the matter is that we need to give the, make sure that the regulator does have those powers, that it should be part of the regulator's remit to continuously investigate what is happening and what protective measures are being put into place in different jurisdictions. So I would not be as concerned by saying, are we completely wrong to put in an age or to not put in an age? I think that we've got to make a decision one way or another around that. But the real issue is an issue of education. What has happened in Australia is, I think, very instructive, because their commissioners have been particularly proactive. Remember, they also were not as late as we are, but they were late comers. But it appears that the Australians as a nation are far more aware of their rights to protection of personal information than most other countries. And the reason has been the education that's gone around it. So I'm not too sure that this is, while it clearly is an important issue, I don't think we're going to resolve it that easily. And we might do well to follow where things are going with the express instructional prerogative on the part of the commissioner, or rather the regulator, to monitor this and see where this is going, and specifically to educate. So that's really the key to it.
That doesn't help us that much, because the problem is where the rest of the world seems to be going is a lower age. Okay?
Not necessarily.
We're going. I know, but it's an issue of, yes, but I mean, I'm just going on, and I haven't had a chance to read it properly, but this submission, which is none of the jurisdictions surveyed require parental consent for children between the ages of 13 and 18. My worry is we are saying consent from, effectively consent for those below 18. And we're passing a law that basically that's it, that's what the law says. It goes to the regulator, there's a complaint to the regulator from some more conservative person who doesn't like some of the social networking, and the regulator looks at what's in the law, and what they've got to do, and they've got no choice but to issue an enforcement order. I want some provision, which then becomes a bit silly. I want some provision that at least gives the regulator some flexibility. So I don't want a carte blanche. I hear your problems and disagree I hear the concerns that are raised. So I don't think this section can be removed. But it's a question of the way it stands at the moment. It is a little bit impractical.
And we need to have an understanding, just like I said in the discussion, of what are the risks against which we should put.
Well, unfortunately, Mario, leave that, because you were out when Mark was raising
it. I was right there. But then every time I get penalized, and I hear it. When I grew up, and probably when you grew up, the German, we were told by our parents, don't speak to strangers. Was part of the education, don't speak to strangers. What we now need to tell our children, don't give your telephone number on the internet. Don't give your real name on the internet. You use an alias. It is part of the education.
But look, can we look at some kind of keeping this as it is, but some kind of clause giving flexibility, so that if there is a complaint, the way it's phrased at the moment, I would see the regulator having no choice but to issue an enforcement notice to say stop, shut down the exit. Okay, and there may be others that may come later. I mean, I'm talking about even our South African jurisdiction. Where they look at I don't know, but some kind of flexibility, which can then obviate us having to go on to the question of lowering the age, which is what other countries seem to have done, and that seems to be a complete shot in the dark. And there may be a difference in terms of age for social networking sites versus age for some other supply of information.
Yeah.
I would have thought there should have been a distinction. Can we look at that aspect? And for that, going to version 5. Okay. Can we move? Then the last one then is it the document from Peter Stryker?
Yes.
Okay.
I think we have a conscious of our transport.
Look, I mean, what you want to go?
He was on the 1850 flight, yes.
Okay. But does 1850 there's all right, no, look, there's only one issue here we can look at it and you can make. But I think the issue really then is very briefly that what the technical committee will do next time is go through version 5. So, and the idea would then be that there's a final version, version 6, that we present to the full committee. So you would need to, these changes from today's meeting and last month's meeting, write them up into version 5. I think from the discussion, I'm away next week, and the drafters, Hink and Ananda, want time. But if you could have that ready by the end of next week, by Friday, and we can then set a meeting thereafter to go through that.
You would be emailed by Friday to all of us, or wherever it is. Just email it directly, because I only got 9 this morning.
That's Friday week,
so that's
the
I just want to quickly say about this last thing, it's about the spam.
Yeah.
And I don't think there's any problem, so I don't think it will be necessary to, for instance, include it in the new
chapter.
But I just want to say that, you know, there are, unfortunately, the people that have raised this are very vocal about it, so you may see it in the newspapers or wherever, because they publish it all over, but it's not something to be concerned about.
Thank you. Okay, thank you, everybody.